Okay, am I unmuted? Cool. All right. So today I'm going to talk a little bit about real-time, and it's not necessarily real-time in the traditional sense. So let's make sure we're all starting from the same page. I'm guessing this should not be surprising to most of you. Real-time just simply being systems that are going to provide some sort of statement about when an event happens and when code that was waiting for that event actually starts executing, which is just a long way of saying latency. And if you look at historical real-time systems, you'll actually sometimes see different types of latencies. They'll talk about scheduling latencies versus interrupt latency, because those two numbers might not necessarily be the same. And in addition, if you look at those historical systems, there was always this really, really big deal about hard real-time versus soft real-time. And if you talk to a hard real-time purist, hard real-time is the only kind of real-time that matters, and those are systems where you can, using a mathematical proof, prove what the maximum latency a system might have, usually by using a technique called longest code path analysis, and I'll talk more about that later. And then there was the other kind of real-time, which is soft real-time, which was essentially everything else, which is sort of the ghetto for the real-time wannabes. Traditional real-time, generally you saw them being used in small embedded systems. Usually it was typically uniprocessor systems. And turns out if you're doing SMP systems, this whole maximum code path analysis gets really, really nasty. And generally, these were on smaller systems that had fairly restricted CPUs. And so you might see them for data collection. You might see them controlling the fuel injection on an automobile. And it was that sort of application was sort of what a lot of people would think of as real-time embedded systems, because that was what there was an awful lot of. Well, you get something which is provable so that, an airplane won't fall out of the sky, or, when you hit the brakes, that the brakes will actually engage. And that's actually an important point. I'll actually be getting back to that again, which is, depending on your application, what your requirements are may vary an awful lot, right? I mean, it could be milliseconds, it could be a tenth of a second, it could be a full second, or it could be microseconds. So it all depends on what the heck you're actually doing with the thing. But in general, and I'll repeat, this point bears repeating, so I'll say it now and I'll say it later, real-time does not necessarily mean fast. In fact, very often a real-time system will be slower than a non-real-time system. So in general, everybody wants hard real-time because hard real-time sounds sexy, this whole thing about proofs and whatnot. There's always this connotation of soft real-time as, it's not really real hard time, right? I mean, best efforts, what does best efforts mean? And what would very typically happen with these sorts of systems is anything that was too hard to do would just simply not be considered real-time at all. So, for example, if you take a look at some of the real-time systems where you put the real-time data acquisition task as a kernel module that would just simply get loaded into the kernel, that was where you would do your real-time stuff. And anything that you couldn't actually say anything about in terms of proofs, like, say, TCP/IP or file system access, you would just simply shoot that off in the user space and just simply say, oh, well, that's just non-real-time, so it doesn't matter. SMP is really, really hard to do hard real-time proofs about, and TCP is so complicated that, again, pretty much impossible to do proofs of code path analysis. So very often, traditional RTOSs would either not have TCP/IP, or they would just simply assume that TCP was just not part of the real-time subsystem, and so no guarantees. Well, times have changed an awful lot. If you take a look at a Cray 1, right, the Cray supercomputer, really, really fast computer, 160 megaflops, 8 megabytes of memory. That's an embedded system today. In fact, it probably won't run Mozilla or OpenOffice. not enough memory. You know, Andrew Tenenbaum said something about software bloat. Well, you know, yeah. And the big thing is that systems are just really different, right? You can now execute a hell of a lot more instructions in 10 microseconds than you could 3 decades ago. So in general, if a system doesn't actually get back to you when you think it ought to, it's usually not because you're CPU bound. For these sorts of systems, usually what's happened is, you know, you're waiting for memory, or you're waiting on a spin lock, or you're waiting for the hard drive to get back to you. But it's not necessarily an issue of we're trying to do too much work and the CPU can't keep up. I mean, obviously you could be doing a lot of heavy math crunching and that could still be the case. But, you know, if you talk to a, you know, traditional real-time programmer, they don't do things like that. In general, it's because of things like memory access times or locking issues. Another problem is with modern systems, what people expect to be able to do with a real-time system is, you know, they want to do a whole lot more. I got involved because we have a customer in the defense contractor business that's going to be using a huge, large number of IBM blades, and they're going to be all hooked up together using TCP/IP, and they're going to be using CORBA to make sure they all talk together. I'm not responsible for the real-time orb. I'm very glad I'm not responsible for real-time CORBA, but that's the sort of thing they actually want to do. They want to do, you know, a lot more complicated things, and, you know, if you're going to have several hundred blades and you want to keep them coordinated, you know, there's a lot of complexity just simply right there. Another thing that's changing, and this has become true just in the last year or two, what with Intel shipping quad-core CPUs and AMD is supposed to be shipping quad-core CPUs real soon now, even quote-unquote small embedded systems are going to become SMP just simply because they're going to have multiple cores available to them. You know, I don't know when we'll start seeing the multi-core ARM as the default processor of choice. But I suspect it won't be all that long in the future. So because of all of that, I think what we think of as real-time is changing an awful lot. And then the last one, which is definitely not what I would call a traditional real-time system, but if you take a look at some of the really, really big web application services and SOA architectures, what they're actually doing is you now have a single web request, at least if you've bought into this whole SOA thing, might result in your messages ping-ponging back and forth between possibly a dozen or more servers, all doing various things like, you know, calculating the shipping or calculating the tax, and, you know, each one of these are being done with a separate HTTP transaction. Don't ask me if I think that's a good idea, but people are doing that anyway. And the net result of all of that is if you're having to talk to a dozen different servers before you can actually get a response back to the original web request, all of these latencies are now being added together. And so if we believe that people are still going to continue to write, you know, these enterprise web application servers in this particular way, I'm actually expecting that we will see folks saying, you know, we need to worry about real-time response guarantees in web servers and web application servers just simply because at the end of the day, we want to make sure customers can actually get a response back within, say, half a second. And if we're talking to all these different things, we got to make, you know, we got to have real-time guarantees for each subsystem. And so, you know, that's an awful lot of complexity. I'm not sure I would design a web server that particular way, but lots of people are, so sort of interesting just in terms of something that, you know, might justify some fun hacking at the OS level, which, you know, I'm all about. So the net result of all of this is something where I sort of figured that instead of trying to argue about hard real-time or soft real-time or whether what we're doing is in fact one or the other, I'm going to argue that it's just something completely different. And so instead of getting into this whole flame wars, some of which hit LKML for a couple of weeks about, you know, whether something was diamond hard or ruby hard or different types of hard real time. Let's just call it enterprise real time and just simply sidestep the whole issue. Right? If you get to define the terms, you generally get to win the debate. So the characteristics of what we're talking about here are large SMP systems. These are folks that do want to do TCP/IP. They want to be able to run commercially available middleware products on these systems. We've got multiple customers that are, you know, asking for exactly this, right? So it's not enough for us to use some embedded distribution. We actually need to make real-time work on a system that looked an awful lot like Red Hat or looked an awful lot like Novell. And sure, maybe you might not have real-time characteristics at the database, but they wanted to run the database on the same machine as they were running their other real-time tasks. And they wanted higher-level programming languages, including, God help me, Java. And for a lot of these systems, they don't necessarily need this whole thing about mathematical proofs of real-time. I mean, it turns out that mathematical proofs don't actually mean a whole lot anyway. If you take a look at modern systems, they're so complicated that at some level, it's all statistical anyway. Because after all, you know, what's MBTF, right? If the system hangs, then you're not going to meet your latency guarantee, right? So there was always a certain amount of, we always assumed that the system was going to work. In some of these customers, they're going to be going on battle platforms. And guess what? Battle platforms take battle damage, which means they're having to do redundancies with separate data centers and fiber links and recoveries just simply if, you know, part of the ship is blown up. And so they have to deal with that from that point of view anyway. And so although people hate to admit it, very often empirical testing, as long as you're reasonably certain that your testing is going to catch all of your edge conditions, is about as good as you're going to get and plenty good enough such that, you know, the whole, you know, thing about we need mathematical proofs of security, we need mathematical proofs of real time, you know, people are starting to realize that that's really not practical and they're just simply not going to get it. And, you know, you could argue that, oh, yeah, well, that's just simply a fancy way of you waving your hands, and, oh, yeah, that's just simply soft real time. But some of the numbers that Ingo has come up with using a torture test, which involved, you know, half a dozen or more Kern bench jobs running, some disk-to-disk transfers, disk-to-disk benchmarks, the system receiving a ping flood and sending a ping flood, and then you're still getting average latencies in the single-digit microseconds with the outliers at 20 microseconds. You know, that's a lot better than what most people would think of when they think of soft real-time. So, in fact, Ingo's patch actually can do some really, really cool stuff. And that actually brings us to our next point, which is if you ask a real-time programmer what their latency requirements are, they will always tell you either as small as you can give me or some number which is effectively equivalent to that. And I suspect that's because even in those places where people talked about mathematical guarantees and hard real times, everybody wanted to add engineering pad because they didn't really trust the mathematical proofs anyway. But it's actually an important question because depending on what you are doing, it may very well make sense to talk about real-time systems that have a guaranteed one-second latency. And so here's an example of some potential uses at, you know, pretty high level of what you might want to do with a real-time system in a, you know, military/defense application. You know, and at the very bottom, if you're doing something involving, measuring radar returns, you know, maybe you'll be using custom DSP chips or some sort of custom hardware. You know, if you're going to be doing software radios, you know, actually you might actually be able to do that in software. You might not actually need custom hardware. And you can move up the stack processing incoming information from sensors, actually using that information in some sort of tight control loop, on up the stack to giving the information to some sergeant who's going to be flying a missile using a joystick, to some sort of situation map that gets updated every 30 seconds for use by the generals or the admirals who want to see the big picture. Right, and that's an example of if you're doing something at that top level, you really do want to guarantee that the map gets updated, you know, maybe every 10, 15 seconds or something like that. But certainly you don't need millisecond level guarantees at that high level. So it all depends on what you're doing. And it makes sense to talk about real time even with, you know, a 1 second or a 10 second guarantee. It just all depends on what you're actually doing with the silly thing. So what we actually worked on as a project was we wanted to provide real-time capabilities to our customers, and this required taking the very latest leading-edge code that Ingo was working on. And because when you're working with a defense contractor whose development time for their system might be measured in years, they would really prefer that the system not be obsolete the day the hull hits water. And so you work with these folks, and they very much want to work with leading-edge stuff because they understand this whole concept of, okay, by the time we're actually ready to launch the real official ship, you know, the technology will have converged and become mainstream, and it's all about risk mitigation and taking very, very carefully controlled risks. And so what we did was we took a RHEL 4 user space and replaced the kernel with the bleeding edge kernel with the Ingo patch. And then the only other change that we made, actually that's not quite true. The other major change that we made was glibc. And there what we did was we took a completely stock Red Hat C library and added the two interfaces that were needed for priority inheritance. Everything else was the same from an ABI point of view, so that if you had a third-party application, like a backup application or a commercial enterprise database application, it would actually work on that user space because we didn't change any of the user space ABIs. That was something we were very, very careful about. There were some issues with third-party products that required kernel modules like ClearCase, but that was an IBM product, so we were able to deal with that. So, you know, diving into a little bit more detail about what we actually did, we started with the 2616 kernel, and then we moved in the 2616 RT22 patch from Ingo. And as I mentioned, the two new interfaces, the libc, we had to use some new features that are in the upstream PAM library but wasn't in the version of PAM that RHEL 4 was shipping, so that non-root users could lock memory and request a real-time scheduling priority. And that was because the customer didn't want to run all their apps as root, which, you know, seemed to make sense. So we had to basically add some new functionality into the PAM library so that if you belong to a certain group when you logged in, you automatically got certain resource limits set for you. The only other really sort of brown paper bag thing I had to add was that the customer, because they're a federal customer, wanted to make sure that the Java system was conformant with the real-time specification for Java, which is a Java standard that's controlled by Sun. And unfortunately, RTSJ was originally designed for the embedded world. And so the RTSJ conformance test requires that the JVM actually have direct access to physical memory. And the conformance test actually has tests that will, like, poke memory into physical memory, poke values into physical memory, and then try to read it back and try to test that. In fact, you really can muck with physical memory, which is sort of a disaster. So I provided a kernel module that would allow you to do it, and I told the customer, you need to leave this while you're doing the conformance test, and then I'm going to strongly suggest that you delete this kernel module because it's a really bad idea And then we're going to, you know, send some folks to slap the fun people around and try to make them make it optional, because it just really shouldn't be there. And then there was a huge amount of work that we did, which was just simply finding bugs in Ingo's code and the priority inheritance robust view texts. There were some interesting race conditions that we found, and basically fixed it all up. And then this whole thing, we would actually provide support through the standard IBM support channels, and that's so that we can actually sell it to our one lead customer, and now we're trying to shop it around to other customers in the federal and financial sectors. But I'm not going to go into too much more detail on the business end, just to give you some context of what we're actually doing with this thing. So at this point, let me talk a bit about what's actually in config preempt RT, which is Ingo Molnar's patches. The first edition was high-resolution timers. John Stoltz did a bunch of that work. And it turns out that for the purposes of the real-time Java incremental garbage collector, they needed basically two-digit microsecond timings. So they could actually do a little bit of work in an incremental garbage collector and then get back out. And so we very much needed high-res timers, and hey, look, Ingo Molnar's patch had it. I'll talk a bit more about the changes in kernel preemption and priority inheritance and interrupt handlers on separate slides. So the first thing is the changes in kernel preemption. And for some of you, this will be review, but if you take a look at a normal kernel, a normal Linux kernel basically has standard Unix semantics, which is to say traditional Unix systems were, once you were actually in the kernel would, the kernel code would keep control until it explicitly let another process run by calling schedule or calling some function that ended up calling schedule, or if it returned from a system call or something like that, or if it tried to reference user memory and took a page fault, it could also let some other process run. But other than that, if you're in a system call running on behalf of some process and that kernel code spun in a tight loop generating random numbers for a large buffer, for example, nothing else would have a chance to run, and of course that would do some really nasty things to your latency guarantees. And certainly that wasn't good enough even for some basic audio applications. So Robert Love did config preempt, and basically the trick with config preempt was recognizing that if you had a kernel that was already set up to handle SMP and had spin locks, The spin lock critical sections pretty much were the areas where it was not safe to preempt. And if you were not in a spin lock, then on an SMP kernel, some other process could be running at the same time. And so as long as you were not inside a spin lock critical section, it was actually safe to allow a top half kernel code to be preempted by a higher level process that needed to run either user space or kernel space. And that probably also discovered a whole bunch of SMP bugs really quickly. Hey, it's all good. At least eventually it became all good. Config preempt RT basically took that to the next level. The problem with config preempt is while you're waiting for a spin lock, the CPU is basically just spinning and not actually doing any work. And you can also have issues of higher level processes waiting for lower priority processes to run. And so what config preempt RT enables is spin locks essentially now become mutexes with priority inheritance. And so what that basically looks like is, first let me describe priority inversion, which is the problem. So we've got a low priority process, a medium level priority process, and a high priority process. And we'll start by the low priority process, process C, locking some resource. And we'll just call it R for the sake of argument. And so it's now blocked, and let's assume that something happens which kicks off the high priority process. And so the high priority process starts running, and then at a certain point it tries to grab the resource R. So it basically tries to lock resource R, and since some other process has already grabbed it, it's going to block waiting for that resource. Now, if at that point some medium priority process now needs to run, it, since it's a higher priority than process C, it will grab the CPU ahead of process C, and it will just simply continue to run until it's ready to give up the CPU. And since it's running, it's going to be blocking process C. But the important point is, because A is waiting on C, this medium-level medium-priority process is effectively blocking a high-priority process from even running, because it's blocking a low-priority process that's grabbing, that has access to some resource that the high-priority process needs. So when B finally gives up the CPU, then C can finally run, do whatever it needed to do so that it could unlock the resource. And once the resource is unlocked, then finally A can have a chance to run. But because of this huge gap of time where process B is running, process B has effectively stopped A from actually having a chance to run. And there are a number of ways of solving this problem. The simplest is something that's just simply called priority inheritance. And so with priority inheritance, we'll start exactly the same way. C is going to lock the resource R. A is going to run until it blocks, waiting for R to run. But because we have priority inheritance enabled, when A blocks waiting for this resource, the locking code will realize that C, who owns the lock, should have its priority bumped from low priority to high priority. And so therefore, since process C is now temporarily borrowing the priority of process A, it will run in preference to the medium priority process, which means that now C will immediately run, finish its work, unlock the resource, and once it unlocks the resource, then its priority gets dropped back to its original low priority. And now that R is unlocked, A will actually have a chance to continue its work, and this high priority process is able to continue doing whatever it needs to do, you know, whether that's, you know, detonating a thermite or, you know, launching a missile or whatnot, in a much shorter time period than if A had been blocked waiting for this medium priority process to give up the CPU. Any questions on that? Okay. So one of the other things that's in config preempt RT is simply moving most of the interrupt processing, almost all of the interrupt processing. There's a few bits and pieces, such as timer interrupts, that are actually not done in threads. But pretty much everything else, all other hardware interrupts and software interrupts, are actually done within a kernel thread context instead of at interrupt time. And the net of that is threads now get scheduled and can compete with other processes. And you can actually manually set the priority of these threads. And if you have some really super high priority user space application, it can actually run at a higher priority than, say, the disk interrupt. Now, there's an important thing to remember, which we've been calling the Spider-Man principle. With great power comes great responsibility. If you have a priority, if you have a very high priority real-time thread running at priority 99, and it's blocking your hard drive interrupts from actually getting processed, your system will go south very, very quickly. On the other hand, if you set rules, and for example, with one of our customers, they basically said, if you're running as a real-time task, you will not touch the file system, period, end of paragraph. You will touch the networking. In fact, they actually have a setup where almost everything is being done using networking services and CORBA and whatnot but they don't actually touch the file system in a real-time task. And so we could tune the system to meet their requirements. And we let them know, oh, by the way, don't run, don't grab a CPU and run it, and tie up the CPU forever, because then things will grind to a halt. Turns out they had, the defense contractor had already written into their specification that blades were not supposed to be loaded any more than 50%. And so they knew about that. And part of it is they just simply want safety margins in case they screw up. But under normal circumstances, the application software was never supposed to use more than 50% of a four-way CPU type system. And so therefore there should always be free CPUs to actually handle interrupts, although we did need to turn off interrupt balancing so that we could actually let some CPU grab the interrupt, whatever CPU was actually available. So let me talk about why we actually did all of this. I've already sort of mentioned this whole thing about real-time Java. This is actually something that we announced last fall, and it's called IBM WebSphere Real-Time, but it has absolutely nothing to do with the WebSphere application server. It's just simply a real-time JVM. Don't talk to me. I don't work for IBM marketing. They have their own branding principles or something. It's basically a J2SE, just basically a simple JVM with real-time specification for Java and a real-time garbage collector, and it runs on this Linux real-time extensions, which is currently being distributed as patches and scripts that extend a RHEL 4 update 2 system. So what's actually in that? Basically three features. One is RTSJ, the second is Metronome, which is a real-time garbage collector, and the third is something called AOT, ahead of time compilation. I've already referenced RTSJ. This was actually the first extension to the Java language, so I believe it's Java Amendment Number 1. And at the time, since Sun didn't have a real-time garbage collector, RTSJ doesn't use real-time garbage collection. Instead, what they did is they defined what were called the non-heap real-time threads. The problem is if you're running a garbage collector and the garbage collector needs to move objects around, basically what has to happen is the garbage collector has to stop the world. Every single Java thread gets stopped dead in its tracks while objects are getting moved around as part of the garbage collection path. And in some really nasty cases, that can take seconds. And while that's happening, nothing else is happening. And that's not very real time. And so what RTSJ said is no problem. You can now create NHRT threads, which, since they don't touch the Java heap, don't have to be stopped by the garbage collector. Now, the only downside of that is almost everything, all Java objects, are normally on the heap. And so if you're in an NHRT thread and you touch an object that's on the heap, it's an uncatchable exception and your program dies. So what do you do? Well, what they've added is this thing called scopes. And there are scopes can either be functional scopes, so basically you can allocate memory effectively on the stack, and as long as you pass it down the call stack, it's fine, but you can't pass it up the call stack because then when you return, the memory disappears. Or you can use something called the immortal memory scope, which is effectively an architected memory leak. Sorry about that. Okay. Now, the problem with this is many Java classes will cache objects or whatnot, and if they do that, that class will not be NHRT safe. And there's no definition about what classes actually do this. And so NHRT is really a highly programmer-unfriendly environment. I've sometimes joked that you basically are coding C++ in Java syntax. And so what IBM Research came up with is this thing called Metronome, which is a real-time garbage collector. And it has a couple of different tuning knobs, but it works by running, by stealing very tiny amounts of time from the garbage collector, typically on the order of 100 microseconds at a time. And that meant they had to do all sorts of things to the underlying Java representation so that instead of actually storing big Java arrays, you store little tiny bits of arrays so that you can copy the whole array in under, you know, a few hundred microseconds. And then you can also tune what's the maximum amount of time that's actually used by the GC. Because after all, it wouldn't be very useful if the GC stole 100 microseconds, let the application do 5 microseconds of work, and then stole another 100 microseconds of time, right? I mean, there's a difference between stops and moving like molasses, but that's usually not good enough. So we can actually say things like, okay, the GC will take no more than 30% of the CPU. Now, there is, of course, the possibility that if you're doing something stupid, like, say, parsing XML in raw Java and generating lots of string garbage, that you might generate garbage faster than the GC can actually keep up. And if it's just one of these temporary short-term spikes, maybe you can deal with it by increasing the amount of heap so that you can deal with a sudden burst. Or what you can do is you just simply have to churn up the amount of time that you let the GC run. But at the end of the day, if your application, there's no magic here, right? If the application generates lots of garbage and it generates garbage faster than what you allow the GC to actually do, well, there are two choices. You can either let the GC do a stop-the-world garbage collection and reclaim memory, but of course, at that point, you've blown away all of your real-time guarantees, or you abort the program. And so the first is probably what you would do in a development environment, and the second is what you might do in a real production environment. And apparently nobody else has this, so it's kind of cool. Yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, basically when you're debugging it, it'll actually give you a warning message and you can see what was actually happening. I'm running out of time. Okay, let me just quickly finish up here and then we can ask questions. And the final thing is AOT, which stands for ahead of time compilation. And I'm sort of surprised nobody else has this because it seems pretty obvious to me. Turns out Java really requires just-in-time compilation because it does all sorts of dynamic, subclass loading and whatnot. And so it turned out to be actually fairly difficult to compile Java code ahead of time, at least do so and have efficient code at the end of the day. So that's one of the challenges GCJ has, for example, which is doing compilation right on the spot, is it doesn't know what the subclasses might be to get loaded. So it's hard to actually really optimize the code. So the fact that AOT is sort of halfway between interpreted bytecode and fully optimized JIT code is actually apparently quite a bit of an achievement, but that allows you to nuke the pause time that's caused by the JIT compiler. And so basically the net of all of this is if you don't have Metronome in AOT, then if you're doing standard Java code, basically 1 or 2 seconds, if your latency requirements are such that you need latency better than 1 or 2 seconds, you're forced to use non-heap real-time threads, which is this horrible programming environment. And with the real-time garbage collector, basically we can push the latency pause times for a GC down to, a millisecond or maybe a little bit under that. And so you can now use standard Java code and get real-time performance down to a millisecond or so. And there is a region where you might still have to use C or NHRT for the stuff that's really, really fast, has really, really small latency requirements. Usually that's a very tiny amount of code. And so defense contractors are loving this because, Java has become the next Ada. Funny thing that they were having trouble finding Ada programmers. In the military world, they need real time and they need some sort of object-oriented language, and they're simply doing that using Java. Okay, so I think I'm running out of time. Do I have time for a question or two, or?
How do you want?
Okay, one question. And is there a question? Okay, all right. All right, there.
What's stopping Ingo's patches being patches and not into the main kernel?
Actually, huge portions of them are actually getting merged in. Linus has basically said that he doesn't want config preempt RT to be the default way of doing real time. That if all you're doing is sound, desktop audio and video, config preempt had better be good enough, or we should be fixing those bugs. But if you're using it to control weapon systems or laser welding robots, which is what Thomas Gleixner is doing with his patches, he has no problems with config preempt RT. So, that's all good. I mean, I think it will get merged. It is in the process of getting poured in slowly.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Okay.